is Penn Jillette, Las Vegas, Nevada, sitting here with Michael Goudeau for another CBS Free FM show. And I guess I'll ask you, Mike Goudeau, how excited are you about our guest today?
Yeah, I just can't even begin to explain.
I mean, isn't this your biggest hero?
It's pretty much my biggest hero in the world, yes.
In the world, yeah. I've had big heroes.
Norman Borlaug, Richard Dawkins.
We already had Norman Borlaug. You just said the name.
I blew it.
Do a big build-up.
You're doing a big build-up.
Everybody knows who we're talking about. We're talking about Professor, Doctor. What do you say? Both of them? Professor, Doctor. Richard Dawkins, who is the... If atheism had a pope, it would be... How's that for damning with faint praise? It would be Richard Dawkins. He's at Oxford. He's written the first book he got famous for was the Selfish Gene. Maybe the first book he wrote, I think. And big evolution guy. And the latest book, The God Delusion, which has a quote from us on the back. By us, I mean me and Teller. You don't have a quote on the back of that. we're going to have him on for the whole hour. If you have questions for Richard Dawkins, 866-570-PEN. That's 7366. That's 866-570-PEN, 7366. PennRadio@gmail.com, PennRadio.com. We did not announce to anyone that we were having Richard Dawkins on today, and we still got Gmails with questions because of the rumors we're going to have him on. So I guess without further ado, I hope he's on the line. Cause I know, are you there, Richard?
I'm there, yes.
Good. So how's the book doing?
It's doing fantastically well. It's well up on the bestseller list at the moment, and we're trying to push it up to number one on Amazon.com. But I'm afraid the number one is going to be very hard to shift.
What is the number one now?
Senator Obama.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, you know, Senator Obama, did you read the quote? I mean, it's taken out of context in order to make us happy, but the quote he said about faith?
I didn't read that.
Yeah, so he's a wonderful quote, because apparently he's a very anti-creative design. Intelligent design being taught. His quote was that he doesn't care much for faith, he only cares about things he proves.
Good.
He can prove.
You're fairly faint, Penn. Can you turn the volume up a bit?
Is there any way we can get it a little bit louder for Richard? Oh, the engineers are all scrambling. So,
okay, thanks very much.
We'll work on that, Richard.
Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you great. You're
okay,
coming
fine.
Across great. Because they're working on you. They're working
good.
On you in New York. We have talked about, of course, a zillion times on the air already, the God Delusion, and we're huge fans. I think everybody listening to the show knows about the book. But why don't you just talk a little bit about how you went from, I mean, Selfish Gene and the earlier books are very much, you deal very clearly with the idea of God, but you don't really come right out and do what the new book is, which is really an atheist manifesto. How'd you go from the out of science into philosophy a little more?
Well, I think when I wrote The Selfish Gene 30 years ago, it wasn't really necessary, because at that time it looked as though religion was just dying. And so I wrote a book about science, and science is my main love. And to me, it was sufficient in those days to explain about science, especially about evolutionary science, and the withering away of religion would just kind of follow on. That hasn't happened, especially in America. Religion has gone on to wither away in Europe and in Britain. About 6 years ago, I proposed to my New York literary agent that I should write The God Delusion. And he was horrified. No, I mean, he himself is an atheist, of course, as all intellectuals are, practically. But he said, you'll never sell a book about atheism to an American publisher. So he wouldn't let me do it. But now, 6 years on, he's changed his tune, and the publishers seem to like it very much, and it's selling like hotcakes.
The number three breakfast special. I'm going to let, I'm just seeing that the phones are lighting up, and although I could certainly talk to you for much more than an hour, I want to get a few of the listeners on, because they'll probably have some good questions here. We got Claudia. Claudia, you're talking to Richard Dawkins. How you doing?
Hello.
Can you hear okay, Richard?
Hello.
I can hear, yes, that's fine.
Good. Go ahead, Claudia. Claudia?
Hello?
Hello, Claudia.
Okay, here I am. Hello?
Go ahead. Yes. You've got Richard Dawkins on the line. Why don't you ask him a question?
Sure. I was wondering where you thought that moral values came from.
Well, the one place moral values don't come from is the Bible, and you can easily tell that by the simple exercise of reading the Bible. If you do that, you'll be horrified by the morals that you learn from it. So they do not come from the Bible.
I agree with you, but I didn't, you know, people always come up with that question
utterly bizarre question to ask. I mean, of course, you can find nice verses in the Bible if you look hard, and you can find horrible ones. And what we do is we pick and choose the nice ones, but we have to have a criterion for deciding which are the nice ones. And that criterion is available to us whether we're religious or not. Now, moral philosophers over the centuries have developed the theory of morals, and it's sort of things like the golden rule, do as you would be done by, do to other people as you would wish them to do to you, and more sophisticated versions of that. And we all of us actually live by that kind of principle. So religion is pretty irrelevant to morals.
What about the argument, and I think Madeleine Marie O'Hare made this, that if you are religious, you cannot be moral because you're not doing it because it's good, but rather because of reward or punishment.
Yes.
Do you buy into that
yes,
argument
I mean,
at all?
If the only reason you do good is because you're afraid of being watched by the great surveillance camera in the sky, you're afraid of going to hell if you do bad and you want to go to heaven, that's a pretty ignoble reason for doing good. People who do good for the sake of doing good are the ones we should really respect.
Any other questions, Claudia?
No, that answered my question. Thank you so much for your time. Love you guys.
Oh, thanks so much. Thank you. I think we should also put in that Claudia did throw in there that she very much agrees with you. She just wanted to know how to answer that question
yes.
when she's asked it.
I think I gathered that, yeah.
866-570-PEN-7366. I got a letter here that someone wrote in from New Zealand. I understand that there's a possibility of Richard Dawkins appearing on your show later today. If so, I'd like to take the opportunity to ask him a question. Richard, I admire your attempts to instill logic and reason into the minds of faithful zombies, and I find myself wondering if you considered a more, excuse the pun, intelligently designed approach to subverting the troglodytes. Logic is a tool of the devil, so perhaps the best tactic is one that uses stealth or humor.
I know, yeah.
Hail Xenu, Chris from New Zealand.
Okay. That's a point of view that I'm meeting increasingly in letters that I'm getting on this tour. Many, many people are saying, yes, of course, you've got logic on your side, but what's the use of logic when you're dealing with illogical people? You have to appeal to their emotions. You have to say what will comfort them. Well, I can sort of see I can see what lies behind that. It's not my way, however. Maybe there are other people who can approach the problem in that way. But logic and reason and science are the only ways I know. That's what I do best. So I'm going to carry on doing that. Maybe other people can pursue the emotional tack.
And speaking of which, I read the transcript. I did not watch the tape of it, but I read the transcript of you on Colbert. I'm on there next Thursday. Any tips? Did you like the way that went?
Yes, well, I had been warned when I first saw him when he was interviewing Kenneth Miller. I was absolutely aghast. I was outraged because I didn't tumble to the fact that he wasn't for real. That's what I mean. But I'd been fully briefed and fully warned and fully trained, and Colbert himself came into the dressing room and introduced himself and said, "You do know I play a complete idiot, don't you?" And so I was fully prepared. I think he's an awfully nice man. I like him a lot.
Now, did he tip his hand at all? Did he say that he was an atheist?
No, he didn't say that. And I mean, opinion seems to be about 50-50. Some people think he is an atheist, some people think he isn't. I'm inclined to think he probably is what he says he is, which is a Roman Catholic. But a Roman Catholic of a very, very unconvinced type. I should imagine he's the kind of person who vaguely gets a warm glow when he thinks about his Catholic upbringing. But as mm-hmm. to whether he actually believes in a supernatural being, I suspect he's probably too intelligent for that.
Well, that brings up a point I wanted to talk to you about in the New York Times book review that put you on the front page this week.
Yes.
The guy had this, what I find, a very smarmy and inexcusable attitude that's kind of like, well, maybe it does some kind of good, and even if it doesn't, you shouldn't be trashing it this hard. But he ends with this quote that I don't remember exactly who it's from. I don't remember it word for word. But essentially, that is the glory of God, that he can redeem us even if he doesn't exist. And yes. when I when I finished reading that quote, I really wanted to hear what you said after he finished saying that. Do you have any comments you'd like throw on to the end of that review?
Yeah, that kind of thing just makes me sick. I mean, it makes me want to throw up. Dan Dennett has quite a good phrase. It's called belief in belief. These mm-hmm. people don't actually believe themselves, but they believe in belief. They feel, I mentioned the warm glow just now, they feel a warm glow about the idea of belief. And it's something kind of patronizing and condescending about suggesting, well, of course, we don't need God because we're too intelligent, but the masses do in order to be consoled and comforted and in order to get through life. So whether or not God actually exists doesn't really matter. What matters is the good effect that he can have on people's psychology or on society. I think there's something nauseatingly condescending and patronizing about that.
Well, I find that a lot of the attitude, what's considered the liberal attitude toward religion, and even the attitude toward tolerance, as the word tolerance is often used, it is interchangeable with condescension.
Yes.
You know, if these Muslims want to wear veils, well, kind of let them. We know it's not that important and they have to have their rights and so on. And it seems like the only way you can respect someone who is a hardcore Christian is to say, I disagree with you, you're wrong. And I found it when we do our show, a lot of people confront me afterwards talking about religion. And I find that I get along much better with the fundamentalist Christians than I do with the liberals who, because at least they don't have the condescension.
Yes.
At least they'll look me in the eye and say, you're wrong. And I can say that back, and it seems like you can have a discussion. Have you found that at all?
Yes, I think that's very shrewd. I mean, I agree with that. The thing that really pisses me off is that, I mean, I'm quite happy to respect anybody enough to argue with them. That's what respect means. You argue with them and you take seriously what they say and you tell them why you think it's wrong. What pisses me off is the attitude that religion has to have a kind of special wall of respect around it. You're not allowed to criticize it. They retreat behind a wall of faith and say, oh, you can't penetrate that wall. That's faith. You can criticize my politics. You can criticize my opinion of art or football or anything you like, but you're not allowed to criticize my religion. That's protected holy ground. That's what really pisses me off.
And that seems to be more of an attitude of what we'll call the New York Times kind of liberal than it is with your really hardcore religious people. The hardcore religious people will argue with you, whereas there's that wall that's so yeah. bothersome there. I want to take a few more calls because there's such great ones coming in. We're just filling up all the lines. Let's talk to Scott. This is Scott. You're talking to Richard Dawkins, sir.
Hi, Ben. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Richard, I apologize. I don't know of you. But
that's okay.
I was on the radio one a little bit ago, and I really, really enjoy the conversation. I love to find that, and I definitely agree that humanity over the ages has had to, I guess, based on some instinct, has to believe that there's something bigger than themselves, and therefore they have to have some belief system and they have to work within that, That is has worked in some regards. It's also gone bad in some regards. But I'm like you. I agree that people, you have to do good to be good. You do good because it's a character trait. It's something that you should do because it's the right thing to do.
I think Scott, you've already said a couple things that certainly I disagree with, and I'm willing to bet Richard does. Do you have a question you want to bring it around to, or do you want to just jump in now?
No, the question is. Do you think that although we have religion out there and people do blindly follow it and they are being good because of that as opposed to being good because they should be good, has that in some regards helped society because it's prevented some bad stuff? I know, obviously, many of the wars have been created by religion.
Let him jump in and answer that, Scott.
I doubt that. I mean, I'm all for people being good, but as you say, people are good for all sorts of reasons, and I doubt if there's any general tendency for religious people to be good. What interested me about the beginning of your question was when you said people need to believe there's something bigger than themselves. And of course I believe there's something bigger than myself. I mean, I believe that the universe, there are unknown things in science. There are things that the science that science of
I totally agree, yeah.
is going to discover, which will simply fill us, will shatter us with awe. If we could come back in 1,000 years and see what scientists have discovered, we should feel so puny, insignificant today compared with what science will tell us about the universe. So yes, there is certainly something bigger than us, but whatever it is not the petty, puny God that people go around worshipping today.
Now, do you think one? I had to hang up because he was getting a lot of his cell phone was getting a lot of interference.
Yeah.
But I'll jump in here. One of the things that that a good friend of mine has said that I thought was so fascinating and haven't heard many people discuss is the idea that there's this feeling that people who aren't religious are kind of cold and uncreative.
Oh God! Yeah.
And his point is that any 5-year-old can make up Adam and Eve or the world on the back of a turtle or any of the creation myths,
yes.
whereas the creativity comes in things like black holes,
yes.
which are so much harder to think of and you can prove. Have you heard that argument made
well,
much?
Your friend is absolutely right, and I couldn't agree with him more. There are, of course, hundreds, thousands of creation myths all around the world. There's absolutely nothing special about the Adam and Eve, which just happens to be the Jewish Babylonian creation myth. There are hundreds of them, and they have a certain, some of them at least, have a certain poetic imagination to them. But the imagination, the poetic imagination of the modern scientific view, black holes, quantum theory, and indeed my own subject of evolution is so much more imaginative, so much more poetic, and it has the enormous advantage of also being true.
Yeah, I just think that that's the part that there is that feeling that scientists are automatically cold or don't understand art, or that there's something that's lost in your life as soon as you give up. And that's the infuriating one, because your scientists tend to always want to keep things cold and rational during the discussions, and they're right to do that. But what ends up is that the nuts get the credit for having all the passion.
Exactly.
And that's what always breaks my heart.
Yes, me too. I wrote a book called Unweaving the Rainbow about 10 years ago, a bit less, about 8 years ago, which was about that very subject, about the poetry of science. And the Unweaving the Rainbow comes from a line of Keats who accused Newton, the great Newton, of spoiling the poetry of the rainbow by explaining it. And so for Keats, Newton was a cold, empty-hearted scientist, whereas actually Newton's explanation of the rainbow, and by that I mean all scientists' explanations for all things beautiful, actually make it more beautiful and more wonderful and more poetic. And that was the message of my book, Unweaving the Rainbow.
Well, we've got Richard Dawkins here for the full hour. We're going to take a little break now. We'll be back. 866-570-PEN. That's 7366. PENradio@gmail.com. PENradio.com. We're going to get to a lot of calls. Thank you, Richard. We'll be back soon. This is Penn Jillette here on the Free FM, CBS, with Michael Goudeau. We have Richard Dawkins as our guest, 866-570-PEN, 7366, PennRadio@gmail.com, PennRadio.com. I want to make have a little confession here to Richard and also to the people who are listening in, and that's to say that I am selecting whose letters I'm reading and who I'm picking on the phone very, very carefully. We have a zillion, and I mean this literally, a zillion calls and emails that just say that Richard Dawkins changed my life because of reading The Selfish Gene. I am now in the field of
PhD
in genetics, that my family was Roman Catholic and Jewish, and we're raising our kids to be without the burden of religion, and you've changed our life, and your books and your videos are the most wonderful thing in the world. I'm skipping all of those, Richard. Just so you know.
I can tell you how pleased I am to hear all that, nevertheless.
Well, I can forward them to you, because there's just hundreds of them that you know, and the lives you change also include the two people who are on the microphone here. Certainly Michael Goudeau and
absolutely.
Certainly me. But I've got some, I want to go for the more nutty ones that I think might get goofier answers. So forgive me for that, but please know that most people are just saying it's the greatest book ever written, the greatest story ever told, The God Delusion. Dear friends, Some parasites, viruses, and flukes particularly, affect animal behavior. You may be aware that Toxoplasma gondii may be the cause of some forms of schizophrenia. Now, how about this? I'm just connecting the dots here. Since we have so many different viruses in our body, would it be possible that it's a real virus, not a mind virus or meme, be the root cause of religion? A particular virus could affect human propensity to believe in weird things and gather with other believers. This behavior change could surely not so incredible as the known effects of Toxoplasma. Since some viruses are almost 100% in human populations, this yet identified virus could match the human religiosity percentage. There's an advantage for the virus.
I'm getting a lot of crosstalk. There's another voice in the background.
Is there really?
Are you getting that too?
Check out of that. No, we're not. It's probably in New York. Would you give New York a call? Give New York a call. He's getting some crosstalk. This is a guy named Francois Choquette who wanted us to mention his name. Is it possible, have you considered the idea that it may not be a meme but an actual real physical virus that that leads people to be religious?
Well, that is a fascinating thought. I think there's no evidence for it. It would be nice to investigate that, but I suspect it's a slightly far-fetched idea. I do think that it's a kind of virus, but the questioner specifically asking me, do I mean a mind virus or an actual proper DNA virus like the flu virus? That's what he means. I'm inclined to regretfully to say that I don't really think it's there is a very strong voice in the background that I'm hearing, which is quite distracting.
Yeah, well, Happy Jack is getting on the phone.
In your own studio, is it?
No, it's not in the studio. It's in New York, and we're on the phone right now trying to take care of that.
Okay.
And in the meantime, try to put up with it for a second, and we'll keep going.
It's not going over your airwaves.
No, it is not. It is not at all.
So
if you can ignore it, then we'll get rid of it while we're...
I'll do my best. It's quite hard. I'll do my best.
Okay. I'm so sorry. We taking care of that, Jack? Just give me a thumbs up. You got someone on the phone? It should go away soon.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, we're going to take we're going to talk to Paul. You're talking to Richard Dawkins. What's up, Paul?
Hey, how's it going, gentlemen?
Very well, thank you. Very well. What's up?
I was just wondering what Richard thinks about technology and evolution. Like, if we're getting to the point where human beings are almost capable of intelligent design ourselves.
Well, we've been capable of intelligent design for a very long time. I mean, that's what planes and cars and computers are. You mean intelligent design of biological things?
Yeah, most definitely.
Okay.
Like for replacing organs and possibly creating new ones and all sorts of stuff like that.
In a sense, we've been doing intelligent design of biology for thousands of years by selecting. We've selected cows that make a lot of milk, horses that run fast, dogs that look funny, roses that look beautiful. That's all intelligent design. It's intelligent design using the selection half of the Darwinian process. The other half, the mutational half, which is the generation of genetic variation in the first place, that's just beginning to come on stream as a possibility for human intelligent design. Humans can now begin to start thinking about deliberately inducing mutations to their own design. That may become a big issue in the future. At present, it's just beginning. It's something that needs very careful thinking about because it could lead to all sorts of things that people might think undesirable. But yes, it is something that probably will be part of the science of the future.
Now, Richard, about that, now that we have such a big population and travel around and the whole Darwinian pockets that break off into different species, in what sense is the human race still evolving, and in what sense have we stopped evolving?
Well, that's a difficult question. Certainly, natural selection, in the conventional sense, isn't nearly so strong as it used to be. There was a time when most individuals born died before they reached adulthood, died before they were able to reproduce. So there really was natural selection in favor of ability to survive, which might have meant things like ability to run fast, keen sense organs to detect the approach of predators, the same kinds of things as affect wild animals generally. Nowadays, at least in large parts of the Earth, humans are immune to that. It's pretty easy to survive to adulthood. It's pretty easy to reproduce if you want to. And so the difference between survivors and non-survivors is no longer literally bodily survival. It's whether they reproduce, it's whether their genes survive. Some individuals do reproduce and other individuals don't. Some have lots of children, others have none. If there's any genetic component to the variation between people who do have children and those who don't, then by definition we have natural selection. I rather doubt, though, if that's having much of an evolutionary effect, because the difference between people who have large families and people who don't have children is probably a largely cultural difference or educational difference or, anyway, a non-genetic difference.
Well, you know, you have a lot of people, and again, this falls into the condescending thing that also makes me sick when people say it. But, you know, I've just recently had two kids, and the number of people who said to me, well, it's really good that you're having kids because stupid people are having so many more kids than smart people. We have to reproduce. And it always gives me this really sick feeling that I'm being talked to by someone who is just full of hate. And I wondered if you just comment a little bit more on that. You already touched on it, but that kind of thing that's being said an awful lot, I would really like you to just say that there's no truth to it, if that's what you believe.
Well, there was a time when that kind of thinking was very strong, and in the early part of the 20th century, people like J.B.S. Haldane, R.A. Fisher, the great founding fathers of population genetics, would have been quite happy to say things like that. R.A. Fisher himself, who was one of Darwin's great successors in the early part of the 20th century, actually, you'll be very sorry to hear this, had an extremely large family for precisely the reason which you're I mean, he was a very, very smart man, and he believed in breeding, because for that reason. That whole thing became very, very unfashionable, I think partly because of Hitler, because Hitler, of course, was the arch eugenicist, and Hitler was completely, as we know, screwy.
we do know that, almost all the listeners.
Yeah, I mean, Hitler has given all kinds of eugenics a bad name. I think I agree with you that it would be very a very unpleasant thing if there were to be a sort of government organized breeding program to say let the smart people breed and encourage the dull people not to. I think that would be a horrible thing. That's different, however, from saying that it wouldn't work. And there are a lot of people who go around saying it just wouldn't work, and I fear that they're saying that because for ideological reasons they don't want it to work. But I mean, let's get away from smart and dumb and talk about something a little bit more neutral. Suppose there was a nation that wanted to win the Olympic Games, say, I don't know, win the high jump or something in a couple of hundred years' time. Some kind of breeding program in which you take male high jumpers and make them to female high jumpers, if you were a kind of mad Hitler-type dictator, that would probably work. At least there's a good chance it would work. I hope that we don't do it, but I'm not going to come out and say that it's actually a scientific impossibility that would happen.
Well, considering the kind of goofy dogs we've created in a very short period of time, if we were allowed to completely control the breeding of humans, we certainly could get as much variation we got in dogs, right?
That's right. You could, and by the same token, you would probably get all sorts of things you hadn't bargained for. You'd think you were breeding for, I don't know, high jumping. And before you knew where you were, you'd be breeding a whole lot of people who, although they might be able to jump very high, might be absolutely hopeless at all sorts of other things. It's very, very difficult to keep a balance between the different things you breed for. So if you try to breed for, say, cleverness, or try to breed for musicianship, or try to breed for sprinting speed or something, you might succeed. But just as when you breed cows for high milk yield, you get cows that can hardly walk because their udders are so big, dangling between their legs.
Well, that's one that's kind of related that we can see. There are also other ones that just ride on board that we'd never guess about.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. There's a fascinating piece of work on foxes that was done by some Russians, I think, in the 1950s. They took foxes and they bred them by artificial selection for tameness. So they were, in effect, trying to turn foxes into dogs by breeding them for domestication, for being nice to humans, for being tame with humans. And they succeeded. but they also found that there were a whole lot of other things that came along with it. These foxes really started to look like dogs. They started to, instead of being fox-coloured, they started to get black and white colouring like a collie. They started to get floppy ears like a collie. They just became dog-like in all sorts of ways you'd never have dreamed of. I mean, why on earth should you expect that if you breed foxes for tameness, you suddenly get them coming out looking like collie dogs? And that's what happened.
I was hoping you'd get to that. That's what I was kind of driving at. We're getting another little break, Richard. We'll be back with you after that. 866-570-PEN. PENradio@gmail.com. PENradio.com. Give us a call. Talk to, one of our biggest heroes in the world, Richard Dawkins, who's on the show with us today. This is Penn Jillette. Yeah, this is Penn Jillette here with Michael Goudeau in Las Vegas. And we're talking to Dr. Richard Dawkins, whose new book, The God Delusion, is we're doing everything we can to get it to the number one seller at Amazon, and is just one of our heroes. And Richard, I'm gonna give you one of the questions we've got here. I said earlier that we're getting hundreds of Gmails that are all just praise, but some of them come with questions. What are Dr. Dawkins' thoughts on the New Age belief expressed in movies like What the Bleep, the bastardization of quantum mechanics to explain God and spirituality? I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Yes, I'm worried about that, because although I long for the demise of religion, what really saddens me is that often when religion goes, it gets replaced by something that might even be worse, which is a kind of total empty-headed belief in anything. And that's what much of this New Age claptrap, I'm sorry to say, is. And one of the things that they do is to latch hold of scientific jargon. I actually know a bit about this now, because I'm in the course of making a two-part television documentary called The Rational Inquirer, which... it's rather similar to one I did on religion earlier this year, called "Root of All Evil." The same team,
which you can see on YouTube over here in the U.S. And a lot of people have asked. So I might as well interrupt you and get this.
Yes.
Any chance of this being shown on proper broadcast TV?
I don't think it's going to be. I've heard of no plans for it to be actually broadcast in the United States. I don't think that American broadcasting stations, on the whole, have the courage to do it. It is, however, going to be marketed as a DVD, and you can, it's not quite out yet, but you can find links to it on richarddawkins.net. So that's
okay.
richarddawkins.net.
richarddawkins.net,
yes.
And we had a copy that you gave us of that, and we watched it over my house with about 20 people, and I'm surprised you didn't hear the cheering over at Oxford. It's one of the greatest shows I've ever seen. But forgive me for interrupting you, but I didn't want people to know that they should see that, The Root of All Evil, with, I believe, the greatest advertisement, the most chilling advertisement I've ever seen for anything. Was that your idea, or was that the ad department?
Do you mean the one about the New
York
Times?
Why don't you describe it? Yeah.
Well, the British newspapers had an ad for it, which had the picture of the Manhattan skyline with the twin towers of the World Trade Center conspicuously present. And the caption was, "Imagine a world with no religion."
Was that your idea?
No. Channel 4 did that well, I must say.
Very, very well.
Anyway,
now, I'm sorry, I've interrupted you twice now, but why don't you get back to the...
The same team from Channel 4 who made that film are now making another one with me as the presenter, which is called The Rational Inquirer, and it's about all sorts of other kinds of irrationality apart from religion. So mm-hmm. It's about telepathy and astrology and psychic divination and...
Hey, wait a minute, that's our show!
I know. This is a British equivalent.
You need a writer?
anyway, so I've been around interviewing psychics and mystics and New Age people talking about ley lines and things. And one of the things I've noticed is that they love lifting jargon from modern physics, especially. They love quantum theory. They talk about quantum energy and energy vortices and quantum vibrations and things. They haven't the foggiest idea what quantum theory is all about, but it sort of sounds good. It has a good sort of emotional resonance. So they're actually using science and turning it into a kind of distorted quasi-scientific religion. And it distresses me very much. I think it distresses me almost more than the conventional religions which have been around for centuries.
I'm going to ask you another question here that I have no idea where this person is coming from, but I'm going to throw it at you here. Please ask Dr. Dawkins what he thinks regarding gay and lesbian couples adopting children. If you believe that some people breed and some people do not, and that is an evolutionary factor, why should we allow someone who refuses to breed naturally to raise children?
I'm a believer in freedom in this sort of thing, and so I don't want to get in the way of what people very, very much want to do. I'm, however, not familiar with the actual political issues in the United States, and so I don't want to get involved in particular things. I know there are various voter questions on various polls in the forthcoming election about gay marriage and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the particular local issues are, but my general instinct is if somebody wants to do something, they should be allowed to do it.
Yeah, my understanding of the question, however, is a little bit more science and a little bit less politics, which is if the idea of evolution is to pass on the genes that are done properly, why should we let gays and lesbians who aren't breeding pass this on? It seems to have the question reverses nature and nurture halfway through. But I just want to know if you had anything else to say about that.
Well, you could say that about people who are, about heterosexual couples who say adopt because they can't have children of their own, and that maybe they would like to have children, but they're not able to.
Absolutely. I'm going to take another call here. Let's talk to Vincent. What's up, Vincent? You're talking to Richard Dawkins.
Hi, how are you? First of all, Penn, great show.
Thanks.
You know, it's great that there's actually a forum where these ideas can be openly discussed. Mr. Dawkins, basically my opinion, or my question is, what do you think the world would be like during that transitionary period where you say earlier that science will shatter us with awe? Once the world is shattered, you know, what do you think the transition period will be like? When I have conversations with people, they throw these ideas that basically we're going to fall into chaos and people are going to kill each other for no reason. What is your thought on that?
This is the most extraordinary idea, isn't it? That the moment God's off the scene, people are going to start killing each other and raping each other and things. I actually spoke to, I was on another radio show. It was actually Fox News Radio.
Mm-hmm. Sorry about that.
And somebody phoned in and literally said that if he didn't believe in God, he would start killing people. And the compere of the show, I've forgotten his name, Alan Combs, I said something like that. Mm-hmm. Actually started pinning him down. You mean you really would? He said, yes, I would. Who would you kill? I'd kill my neighbor, he said. He actually thought that if it wasn't for religion, we'd all go around killing each other. I mean, that is an appalling indictment of religious people. Of course, they're not mostly like that, but anybody who seriously thinks that if it wasn't for the fear of God, they would go about killing and raping and stealing. I mean, that is not the kind of person I would ever want to know, and nor would anybody else. And I don't really believe there are many people like that.
It's also interesting that those who are atheists already, we've run this experiment, those who are atheists do not have, I mean, there's many arguments that we have much lower crime statistics, but I have not seen one article anywhere, one even pseudo-scientific study that says that atheists have a higher crime rate than the general population.
No, indeed. There was a lovely study that was done in a psychological study where somebody tested students who were atheists or religious and various degrees of religiosity. And the form of the experiment was that they were given an opportunity to cheat in exams. They didn't know that they were being watched, but they were given an exam, and in fact they were given an opportunity to cheat, and they didn't realize that they were being watched. The only group who did not cheat in the exam statistically were the atheists. And all the religious groups did cheat, but it was suggested that the only reason the atheists didn't cheat was that they were so smart they could pass the exam easily without bothering to cheat.
Yeah, you know, but what you haven't factored into this, Richard, is the fact that all the people who are religious are are screaming and immoral and just ready to pop, and the only thing that's protecting the atheists is the fact that they have this misconception. And there are a lot of atheists, not a lot, but there's a few atheists I've talked to that seem to believe that. You know, the atheists that, there's always the argument that, you know, perhaps the Pope is an atheist, but just believes that that's the way you should, can control people.
Yeah.
That's so cynical to me. But there are atheists that have said to me, a couple of friends of mine who are Israelis, that just say, oh, no, none of us believe in any of this, but the smart people have to push religion so that they aren't destroyed by the stupid people.
Well, I have heard people say that. It's a very cynical view. I hope they're not right.
Yes, I'm afraid that my optimism about the human race doesn't even allow me to consider that. I hate to get hard evidence on that. Let's talk again. We're coming very near the end, Richard. I want to just say again, your book, The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, is available, I believe, everywhere, right?
Yes.
There's no place you can't buy that. And give your website again so that people can go. A lot of people that heard this show are going to want to find out everything about you.
It's richarddawkins.net. So that's all one word, Richard Dawkins, with no dots in the middle, and then .net. And that's got a lot of stuff on it. It's a lot about the book, a lot about how it's going. It's got a traveling journal by me as I go around the country. I update it. There's a forum for people to write in there, all the book reviews, all the reviews of The God Delusion, many of which are pretty horrible, by the way.
And are there any places that you're speaking that aren't sold out, that somebody
they
that
all
someone
need
listening?
To be sold out. I've had the most wonderful time. I mean, even in places you might not expect, like Kansas and Lynchburg, Virginia, where I was a couple of nights ago. These are places, I mean, Lynchburg, Virginia is the stronghold of the infamous Jerry Falwell.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a absolutely packed house, and there were some people there who come from Jerry Falwell's Liberty so-called university, and they lined up in front of the microphone. And we had a very long, about an hour and a half of Q&A, and these people from Liberty University lined up, and one after the other came up and tried to sort of make points, and as I disposed of each of them, there was a great cheer from the audience. It was wonderful. I mean, they were just cheering.
Yeah, when we used to tour, when we play places that were in the so-called Bible Belt,
yes,
anything we did that was slightly skeptical get huge cheers.
Exactly. I mean, I get the feeling, and I didn't know this, but I'm starting to learn, that throughout the so-called Bible Belt, there's an enormous upwelling of feeling. There are people who have been suppressed all their lives, and now they're finally so grateful, it seems. I mean, I've no illusions. I'm not very eloquent or anything like that, but they're incredibly grateful because I'm saying things which they've wanted to say all their lives and frankly haven't dared. And so I get these cheers from people. It's a kind of letting off of steam, I suspect. And,
yeah, we find that all the time, that people are just saying, it's so glad someone has started saying this. Our guest today was Dr. Richard Dawkins. Go to richarddawkins.net. Buy everything he puts out. If this book doesn't change the world, we're all doomed. Thank you so much, Richard. You know I love you.
Thank you very, very much.